Session number 9484.
Mr. Russell, reel three.
Before I go on to deal with that, there was just one incident which I think is rather important to mention as I'm talking about what happened in Linares. While I was still in bed, and a number of the other chaps told me that there was somebody in town who had let it be known that if they wanted to leave Spain, they could arrange it. And I then inquired a bit more and discovered that it was this honorary British consul. And in fact, he was organising, or trying to organise, desertion from the international brigades.
What was his name? Can you remember?
I can't remember the name, sorry. But I should imagine if one looked up the Foreign Office list at the time, one could find the name of who was the honorary British consul in Linares at the time. And I decided to go down to his office. I was still on crutches and went down. At first refused to see me, but then I said I would stay. And there was a secretary or woman there who said that he wasn't available, and I knew he was. And this man had photograph, picture of Mussolini in his room, in his office there. Anyhow, I let him know that we were aware of what he was trying to do, and we had a real row about it. He denied that he was organising desertion, but that as the honorary British consul, if a British citizen came to him and asked for assistance to go home and they hadn't their own means of going home, then it was his duty to do so.
What evidence did you have that he was organising it?
Well, from what some people had told me, had said that they that he that he had encouraged people to go and ask for repatriation. And
who were the individuals who had been approached by him?
I don't know about. I've forgotten now who they were, but they had. At least they told me that they had said that they weren't interested.
These were people in the hospital?
Yeah. And so it was at that time there was a house near the hospital where there was a girl who had come, was helping in the hospital. And on my way back I had saw her, and so she sort of introduced me to her mother. And I got very friendly with this girl, and but obviously too friendly for her mother's liking. And it was soon she made it very clear to me that my attentions were not welcome at all. And that was... the girl was not allowed to see me, except, and I wasn't even allowed to go into the house. So when I saw her outside the house, it was just I would talk to her through the window, and that was as far as we got.
Do you know what grounds the mother had for objecting?
No, but it was just general, I think, suspicion. And I remember at the time mentioning this to this Protestant pastor I met, who spoke very good English, and he explained it to me. Well, you see, you must understand that in Spain, girls are not allowed to go where they want, and that was that. So we knew, it was made very clear to me, that my attentions were not welcome at all by the mother. Right, naturally, I flattered myself that as far as the girl was concerned, they were very welcome, but...
Now, I interrupted your narrative with you doing this training near Albacete.
That's right.
How soon did you go off to Madrid?
Well, that was I think we, well, it wasn't more than about 3 weeks that it was in the early November that we were told we were going to Madrid, and we got taken down trucks to Albacete, put on trains there, and went up to the Madrid front.
This was still with the French battalion?
Yes, with the French battalion.
What impression of Madrid, the situation of Madrid, did you get when you got there?
Well, we didn't see really anything of Madrid right away. We got out of the, I think it was the Estación del Norte, the North Station. I've forgotten the actual date, of course. But anyhow, it was the first days of November, and all the records show, I think, pretty well the exact date that we actually went into action on the 6th or 7th of November, 1936. So we arrived there at, during the night. The time we got out, it was light, and we marched through the streets, and people gathered round, and the first started saying, I could hear them saying, son Russos, they're Russians. But then they soon realised that we weren't Russians, and there was a tremendous reception, because the word went around, and as we, even before we gathered, while we were getting out of detraining and were forming up in the station yard, and as usual waiting a great deal, so while we were waiting we saw one of the first things that I remember seeing there, these enormous pans of this thing called churros. They're these sort of donut type of thing, but in long strips. The way they used to make them then, there was sort of big pan of boiling oil, and used to, they had a sort of squeezer in which they had the batter, and the batter was squeezed out into the boiling oil into an enormous sort of Catherine wheel circle, you see, and then it would be fried up, and then the thing would be cut into sections and be sold, a piece of paper and all that. So we amused ourselves by having some of this stuff and waiting. And crowds gathered round and were cheering us, and again, a tremendous reception. Well, we didn't realise immediately how serious the military situation was and how close to Madrid the fascists had got. And we were taken into the university city. That was the first encounter of the International Brigade. That was the first International Brigade, which was the 11th Brigade of the Spanish Republican Army, commanded, as we later discovered, by General Kleber, K-L-E-B-E-R, and we went into action in the university city. And there again, it was a great experience, I mean, and in a way a shock, because although University College was not by any means the most dilapidated of colleges, and quite modern in its way, this university city was a brand new university campus, which the main cost was apparently borne by a millionaire Spanish financier called Juan March. And it was the most modern, I mean, really up-to-date in every way, the sort of, for me, sort of luxuriously appointed students' quarters, dormitories, lecture halls, and everywhere. And for lots of, sort of, I say, luxurious installations, including something that puzzled the British for quite a bit, and that was the bidet, which most of the British had never come across before, and took quite a while to get them to appreciate that it's not low and it caused problems. Although, of course, very soon it became quite academic, because with the fighting, the whole of the sewage system was destroyed, and so one couldn't use the toilets in the university city anyhow. So there it was. This was at the edge of the Casa di Campo, and we were the British unit in the building of Filosofia e Letras, the Philosophy and Letters building. The rest of the battalion was in nearby buildings, the clinical hospital nearby, and other buildings. And we rapidly made ourselves as comfortable as we could in the lecture halls facing, and after we'd got installed, and by that time we had been also equipped with Russian Maxim machine guns. Well, most of us were only familiar with Maxim machine guns from Russian films that we'd seen. But as I had done, I was one of the few who had done the training on the Vickers, British Vickers machine gun, I very soon found that it was very similar to the Vickers gun. Except that in many, first of all, big difference was that the Vickers was on a tripod, the Maxim is on a sort of wheels, which we soon found looks all right on film, which is a damn awful thing to have to carry around, and that you can take the gun off the two-wheel sort of carriage that it's on, but the carriage, you have to have one man to carry the gun, another man to carry the actual carriage, and the actual carriage with these two wheels is much heavier and much more difficult to carry around than a tripod. And also didn't give you, in my opinion, the amount of manoeuvre you had actually when firing the gun that you have with a tripod. But apart from that, it was similar in the way it worked, except that, well, whereas in the Vickers, to load the gun, you just pull the cocking handle back twice. In the Russian gun, you have to push it forward twice. But apart from that, it was very similar, the whole mechanism and the cooling system as well, with the sort of problems that you get with the cooling of a gun, as we soon found in the sort of heat that we were to experience. And but we still had, those of us who were with rifles, still had these Austrian rifles, although they soon were changed, for Remingtons in the first. Where these Remington rifles came from, I can't remember. And the Lewis guns. Well, there was a rather amusing incident that I can remember about those first couple of days. We were getting installed, and John Cornford with John Summerfield had gone around and had come across a great store of English books, mostly Everyman editions. So we bought these along. And then they'd also come across two sort of tourist posters that they seemed to me. One which said, which had a picture of the fountains of the Alhambra, and said, "The sun is waiting for you in Spain." And the other, which had a sort of bulls and a bullock cart and all that, and it said, "Spain, the charm of the East with the comfort of the West." And they just stuck these up in this, there was in this lecture hall with a blackboard and all that, and John thought it was a great joke, and then stuck these up. And we had a good laugh about this, and just sat down, when suddenly there was an almighty explosion. The place was full of smoke, I mean. And when the smoke cleared, there was John, blood pouring down his face and head. Well, we later discovered it was one of our own anti-aircraft shells which had fallen short and had come through a wall on one side and had burst there. Nobody was killed. John, he looked very bad, but well, it took John off. And then that afternoon he came back with his head bandaged, looking very heroic and romantic and all that. And,
it was just a scalp wound.
A scalp wound, but there was a lot of blood around and they looked pretty horrific. But it was a great joke. Well, the fighting then got pretty intense. We, at one stage, got out of the building. And we're going towards the fighting across the river Manzanares there. Well, the Manzanares, I mean, it's even today, it's, well, I only passed along it in June, and I was there in Madrid last, and they've cleaned it all up, and it looks like a river now, but most of the time, and it was more sort of ditch, you see, not much in the way of a river. But there was some very savage fighting to and from across the river. And it was there that we first also encountered the problem of the anarchists. There was one day when we were in the philosophy building, and we knew that there was an anarchist unit just further on from the clinical hospital. And Fred Auberger came to us and said, you know, things are very quiet over there. I'd like you to go over, send a patrol over and see what's happening. We went across, I was with the patrol, we went over, and we found that there were only two or three people there. And we said, well, what's happened? Where are the unit gone? Oh, they said, they've gone to the pictures, gone to the cinema. Well, we're just on the outskirts of Madrid, and you went down the road a bit, and you got a tram and take you right to the centre of Madrid. And they'd just gone off.
From the front line?
Mm. Well, we thought this was a pretty poor show, but it was one of the problems with the anarchists, that in the fight they were very, I mean, you couldn't get more courageous people. But they had a very, what, to us, British, and to the French too, a very strange idea of military discipline. Well, it just didn't exist.
They definitely were anarchists, weren't
they? Yes. It was an anarchist unit, and well, there was nothing happening, so off they went. And this made it very clear to us one of the problems that became very, very serious, and that's this, the whole problem of forming a disciplined army. Well, the fighting carried on. We had quite a number of casualties, and one of the serious things was really the sort of accidents that happen in war. We were moving position one night, going along a road, and we noticed some flashing of lights behind us, and it was a lorry coming. We hadn't been told about this. Suddenly we were crossing a small bridge over a railway line, and the road, particularly across the bridge, there were a lot of wires, telephone wires. Suddenly, what turned out to be a lorry behind us accelerated. It turned out later they had thought we were fascist troops, and the Spanish chap there accelerated and drove right through us, scattered. Although we were mostly to the right and left of the road, there were some people in the middle, some people knocked down. And Freddie Jones, then this lorry got one of the wires, broke one of the wires and got it on the front mudguard and pulled it Then he went and lashed around and caught poor old Freddie Jones round the head and really ripped his head off his shoulders, off his neck.
Literally?
Mm. And we found his body and in the morning. Well, we didn't know at the time. Freddie had just vanished, you see. And then when daylight came, we looked around and we found Freddie there dead, and a number of others had been killed. It was just a stupid accident.
Was the person responsible found?
Well, we knew the chap. I mean, it wasn't his fault. He, you know, he thought we hadn't been told, and he hadn't been told, and he thought we were fascists, and that just he had. It was a load of ammunition that he had on board, and that. So we, the fighting was really very fierce there, and. There were opposite us, apart from the Spanish fascist troops, there were Moors. The first time we'd met the Moors. And what we very quickly discovered was the accuracy of their snipers, that anybody who, you know, showed their head, you know, really got it. And you had to be very careful, they had some really crack shots amongst the other Moors. And we didn't, but I say that there was a lot of toing and froing and in building fighting, which in the very short amount of training that we had undertaken, we hadn't gone into at all. So we.
Was there much exchange of territory?
No. No, it was just in and out of the buildings and the Casa de Campo. But what we did do was that we stopped the advance of the fascist troops, because until that time, I mean, they had been advancing pretty rapidly, certainly on the road from Talavera de la Reina. And
when you say we stopped, do you mean the French battalion stopped?
The French battalion, and there were Spanish units, the French battalion and the German battalion. The it was there that I first saw Passionaria, and that it was actually before we went into position in the university city. We had arrived, as I told you, of the North Station, and then after marching a period of a short distance, were put into lorries and were taken during the night. Got ordered to get out of the lorries, and standing there by a road, we didn't know where we were except vaguely near Madrid, and we saw the remnants of the Spanish troops coming along the road. Absolutely and the most frightening sight. I mean, obviously defeated. People who obviously hadn't slept for days, and terrible state. And while we're standing there watching this, saw a small car that came along with two lorries filled with what we could see. There were Russian Soviet rifles and ammunition. And officers in these trucks, Spanish army officers. And we saw, getting out of the small car, a woman and two men in civilian clothes and a Spanish army officer. And she got up on this lorry and started talking, as we could see. We were about 100 yards, 150 yards away. And we saw the number of Spanish army officers then trying to stop this sort of retreat. I mean, it was just a panic, people going along. And after a bit, somebody said, well, you know, why don't we go up and have a listen? So I said to Fred, well, go up and listened. And I asked somebody standing here, and said, "Oh, that's a Spanish communist woman, Pasionaria." Well, I'd heard of her, but... And this was the most amazing thing, the first time I'd seen her in action. This... I mean, these large numbers, there were hundreds and hundreds of people just trying to get out, get away from it. And bit by bit, they got people to stop and to listen. And as some stopped, more and more stopped. Until they had really some hundreds of people. Most of them in the most lamentable condition. I mean, rags, thrown away their arms. And then the officers started getting people formed up into units. And she kept on speaking. I couldn't at that time gather a good deal of what she said, but you know, I could see or hear what she was talking about, the defence of Madrid and that. And in very short time, this sort of absolute rabble of what was only a rabble of defeated people really started forming up. Rifles were distributed, and they marched back in the opposite, you know, the direction from which they had been fleeing. And then Fredo Bruger, the French company commander, came up and said, "Well, no." I spoke French, but and Freddie Jones spoke French. A few of us, Cornford, of course. Bernard Knox was another one. Bill Alexander told me that Bernard Knox had been, I think, professor of Hellenic studies at Harvard University for some years. Well, I think he's retired now. And there was another chap whose name comes back to me, Mackenzie, whose father was an admiral in the British in the Royal Navy. also a student, Bernard Knox, yeah, amazing, I hadn't thought of him in big years. And, well, that was then that, afterwards, that we got into action, and in the university city. And after some weeks there, we got our first leave into Madrid.
What impression, apart from the sniping of the Moors, did you get of the military caliber of your enemy?
Oh, we thought they were very powerful, and was very obvious was that they had enormous firepower that we didn't have. They had artillery, which on our side was very, very, very little artillery, and their weapons were much, much better than ours. Their rifles were much more accurate. I mean, well, I've mentioned the sniping and all that. We had these Russian machine guns, Maxims. They had mainly Spanish Hotchkiss heavy machine guns. I think that our machine guns were better, the Russian machine guns were better than theirs, but we didn't have many of them. They had much more firepower than we had. And also that they were obviously much more experienced than we were. When we were out in the open, they showed much better, greater capacity of use of terrain than we did. The other problem that began to show itself very quickly was the problem of language. While, of course, there was a French company in the French battalion, but we were this small English group, and there were problems, although quite a number of us spoke French, and there was no problem, but we began to feel this problem of language difficulties. But the Moors and the other Spanish fascist troops had... the thing that struck me was they were very good at using terrain. Even in that sort of area, Casa de Campo, Well, it was this large park, sort of park area, very much like Hampstead Heath, even today. But much more open than it is today, because now Madrid is very much built up. And they were very good.